Good, good. Thanks very much for coming out this afternoon to week four of the Oxford Transitional Justice Research Seminar Series. It's a real honour to have with us today Benjamin Ferenc, who I know needs absolutely no introduction to most of you. Benjamin, thank you for filling our audience. It's a tough thing to do in the middle of Trinity term, especially at 4:30 on a Wednesday, but I think it's testament to your career and the impact that it's had that we have an audience like this. Benjamin, of course, is the oldest living prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials. He's also at the moment co-director of the Planethood Foundation, which is an organization that is very dear to our hearts here at OTJR. They've been very strong supporters of our work and funders of our seminar program for the last 2 years. So we're very, very grateful to Benjamin and to Don and to Planethood for that. Benjamin started out his career with a degree from City College of New York. He then won a scholarship to Harvard. After his studies, he joined the US Army. But very quickly, I guess, found himself in the kind of legal work that he's clearly best known for. He was honorably discharged from the Army in 1945, had 3 weeks back in New York, and then found himself basically back in Nuremberg, prosecuting some of the most serious alleged suspects of the Nazi Holocaust. We're, of course, going to hear, I think, a great deal about Benjamin's experience of the Nuremberg trials and then the work that he's done subsequently to them. Since Nuremberg, Benjamin has published quite vastly on a range of international law and international relations subjects. I think very dear to his heart is the issue of the crime of aggression and a whole range of international legal mechanisms around that. Benjamin has also been very involved on the International Criminal Court's working group on the crime of aggression. And this, of course, is leading up to the ICC's review conference in Kampala, which starts on Monday. So I think we're also going to hear a great deal about Benjamin's work looking forward for international justice and the future of the International Criminal Court in that regard. That's enough from me, I think. I'm actually going to now hand over to Don Ferenc, again, co-director of Planethood, who's going to say, I think, a couple of quick words, and then we'll hand over to Benjamin after that. Thanks, Don.
Thanks very much. My name is Don Ferenc, and I was here myself about a week or two ago lecturing on the crime of aggression. I've been working also with the working group on the crime of aggression. But it's a great pleasure for me today to introduce my father, Benjamin Ferenc, who you're going to hear from in a moment. Particularly a pleasure because I know that if I let him get started, he may get started and forget that right behind him is a video clip that we want to show. So before I even let him talk to you, I'm going to ask Nikki to push on. And what you're about to see is the opening statement that my father made at the age of 27 at the Einsatzgruppen case in Nuremberg. Unfortunately, after the judge says that we're ready to hear from the prosecution, there is a sentence that is left off of the transcript. Somehow it wasn't captured. But you'll get the gist of what this was about. And as soon as this is done, when the lights come back on, you'll see Ben Ferenc a few years later, as in 65 years later.
You're now ready to hear the presentation by the prosecution. This was the tragic fulfillment of a program of intolerance and arrogance. Vengeance is not our goal, nor do we seek merely a just retribution. We ask this court to affirm by international penal action man's right to live in peace you mind. Genocide, the extermination of whole categories of human beings, was a foremost instrument of the Nazi doctrine.
Lights, camera. I don't think I'll get behind there because nobody will see me. But if you don't hear me, hold up your hands. We'll be equal. I have some hearing aids in here. I usually keep them in my pocket. Anyway, I have not yet received any notification of what I'm supposed to talk to you about. But since I got instructions from the audience, which is much more important, let me tell you what I plan to do in response to your requests. First, I have in the first row sitting here an Israeli judge. Who asked me, something which will concern most of you, how did you get the job? So I will have to tell you how I got the job, and some people would like to know how did it all begin, what was it like to be prosecuting mass murder?
A little louder.
Mentality?
A little louder. Louder.
That's my son who wants it to be louder. He wants to leave. All right, nobody has a microphone. I'll speak a little louder for you. Is that, can you hear me? Okay, that's too bad. Well, the mentality of the mass murderers is an important subject. We have some medical students here. We'd like to know a little more about the medical advantages. What was the legacy of Nuremberg? Some of you have asked me, what about the International Criminal Court today? How is it functioning? And what about the Kampala Conference, which is coming up? So those are all the subjects which I hope to cover in the space of half an hour or so, and then we'll open up the floor to questions. You can ask me whatever you like on any subject. I don't promise to answer, but I will entertain the question. So let's begin at the beginning. How did I get the job? It has been mentioned briefly that I was a graduate of the Harvard Law School. I was raised in poverty with an immigrant family, came to the United States, fleeing persecution in Romania and Hungary. I was very fortunate, went to City College, no fees to pay. I won a scholarship on my exam on criminal law. One of the professors was doing a book on war crimes. I earned some money doing all the research, which meant I read every book in the Harvard Law Library, which dealt with questions of war crimes at any time in human history. When the war broke out, like all of my other classmates, we felt an obligation to do our part. I felt very indebted to the United States. They had been very kind to me. And so I joined the Army, to some difficulty. And they, of course, immediately recognized my talent, and they made me a private in the artillery. And it was in that capacity that I had some experience with the British Navy. After a little basic training somewhere in Carolina, most of which I was hiding somewhere, they put me on a little boat, and the British were in the Navy, and they dumped me on a beach. I didn't know where it was, Omaha Beach, Normandy, and the British sailor said, that way Berlin, that way's Berlin, yeah, good luck. And so I was launched. And as a member of General Patton's army, we chased the Germans all the way back. There was some resistance. It wasn't very nice. As a matter of fact, it was pretty bad. And I fought in every major battle in the war, and the army being so perspicacious, it's a big word, recognized all this, and they gave me an honorable discharge as a sergeant of infantry, and 5 battle stars for not being killed or wounded, which I thought was a good idea, instead of rewarding the others. However, I then went home, 10 million other soldiers, looking for a job. And it was by chance that a roommate of mine at Harvard was the clerk for Justice Robert Jackson. He asked me, we met on the corner of 4th Avenue and 5th Avenue and 42nd Street, which is one of the most crowded spot in the world. And by chance, he said, what have you been doing? And he was, you know, at home. And I explained that finally, when we got into Germany, the Army had orders from Washington to set up a war crimes branch. Because the President and the British Prime Minister, Churchill, and the French had all, and the Russians had agreed that they warned the Germans that they would be held to account for for the crimes which we knew were being committed. We already had reports coming in from England, where there was a so-called United Nations Commission of Lawyers. They had nothing to do with United Nations, as you know it today, but they were lawyers, refugee lawyers from different countries, who assembled here in England, and they were receiving reports of the occupied territories of atrocities. And that was being forwarded to people in the United States, including this Harvard professor, Sheldon Gluck, who was writing a book on war crimes. And I read all of these reports. So we knew that vast extermination programs were in process. We didn't know the details of it. But anyway, we had warned them that they were going to be held to account. It wasn't that we just jumped on them. And the army, of course, had no idea whatsoever. Where do you begin prosecuting people for crimes against humanity? Never heard of that. Genocide, never heard of it. I knew Raphael Lemkin, who invented the term. And crimes against humanity was invented by René Cassin, and I knew him too. So the army said, how do we do that? They said, we got a man out there. They went to see this professor. He said, you go see the student of mine, Benny, he's out there somewhere, find him. So they took me out of the artillery. I was then already a corporal, and sent me to General Patton's headquarters. And Colonel met me, and he said, we've got orders from Washington to set up a war crimes branch. Your name has been forwarded to us. What's a war crime? I'm not kidding. And they knew all about a war, absent without leave. They all know about conduct on becoming an officer. They knew about, you know, devastation beyond military necessity, but war crimes, what's that? Well, I explained it to him, and what the historical antecedents had been, and I believe that I was the first man in the American Army to deal with war crimes. The second man who came in about a week later was covered with mud when he reported to me, and he saluted, and he said, Private Nowitz, reporting for duty, sir. They told me to report to you. I said, don't call me sir. I'm just a corporal. And I said, what do you do? Well, he was a Yale lawyer who spoke several languages, and he had been in the engineers. And so he was covered with mud because they pulled him off the job and sent him to General Patton's headquarters. And the two of us represented the United States Army War Crimes Program. And the way we worked that was we'd get a report coming into headquarters. The first one were the flyer cases. Allied flyers were shot down in German-occupied territory, or in Germany, as the planes were flying over. And they were almost invariably beaten to death by the mob in the street. Because the orders came out of Berlin, treat the flyers as war criminals. They are bombing our children and our women and our cities. And some of the people, or personally affected by the previous bombings a week before, and their own children had been killed and things like that, and they joined in the mob and beat up the flyers and killed them. And so I would go out, say, Jack, Nowitz, you take this case there and I'll take these cases here. We'll meet next week, we'll come together and see what we've got. Drive out to the scene of the crime, catch the police chief if you could catch him. Most of the officials were already out. They ran someplace, but whatever official you could get, bring the people, tell them I want you to bring in everybody who was within 100 yards of that incident, which took place on this day. We had the date usually of the place for interrogation. And he'd bring them in. Yes, I will. Very obedient. Germans are very obedient people. And he'd bring them in. I didn't speak German at that time. I haven't. One of them might say, you speak German? Yes. English? Okay, you're the translator. Now you tell them. I want them to sit down, and we got some paper and pads for them. Write out exactly what happened. Anybody who lies will be shot. People seem to be surprised at that. I didn't think it was surprising at all. Why one's going to tell them, anybody who lies is not going to get any dessert tonight. But what do you do to persuade them? And I knew that they had Bekanntmachung notices all over. The Jews don't show up for assembly to be shipped off to Auschwitz or elsewhere. Todesstrafe was underneath. It was described. So I knew the principle of reciprocity. It never occurred to me somebody would suggest that I, just because I was threatening to kill him, that would be a form of torture or something else. I mention this because the concepts have changed over the years. Okay, in short order, I knew if the 20 people had written it out, 15 of them described it pretty accurately, 5 said they weren't there, I knew what had happened. Go out, try to catch the guy. Who did it? Who delivered the fatal blow? Sometimes there was no fatal blow, they just beat him to death. You didn't, you know. And anyway, I don't want to dwell too much time on that. These are relatively minor atrocities and crimes. Eventually, we put some of those people on trial in the Dachau concentration camp. Now, I'm sure that none of you have ever heard of the Dachau trials. And the reason I say I'm sure, because I discussed this about 2 or 3 years ago with a lady, a colonel in the Army, and she was in charge of the military commission trials. And I said, have you ever heard of the military commission trials in Dachau? She said, where? I said, in Dachau, the concentration camp. She said, no. I said, you're in charge? She said, yes. I said, you better look at the record. The way the trials went was as follows. We'd have the defendants picked up in the concentration camps. We began to run into the camps, as well as the flyer case. The flyer case were easy. We'd have just 2 or 3 or 4 defendants. But the concentration camp, let me take a word on that. You've all seen pictures of it. My job was to get into the camp as fast as possible. By that time, we were getting some reinforcements. We had a team of 5 or 6 people. Several shell-shocked officers were assigned to the group. Most of them considered this recreation and rehabilitation. No idea, no interest whatsoever in the subject. Most of them shell-shocked, who should have been discharged. They were sent to the judge advocate section. Come into an area, first we get a report, there are strange people roaming in the streets and wearing, looks like, pajamas. And there's some kind of a work camp. We did not know the word concentration camp. All we knew that it was an assemblage of people. Okay, I get in my Jeep, and the front I had painted Emeraline, get out of my way, and go into the camp. I would head first for the Schreibstube, the office where the records were. Seize whatever records were intact. You've got to get in fast. It was the trick of the trade. If you waited a day or two before you got in, everything was destroyed. Grab the records, safeguard the area, the Totenbücher, the death registries. The guards were being arrested. They were seized, prisoners. Some of them fled into the woods, beating the inmates on the way, killing them on the way. Then go back and write my report. I entered this and this camp on this and this date. This is what camp was open, so and so. We had these and these transports coming in, different dates. So many, this was the death rate. These were the officers in charge of the camp. I don't want to go into too many details. It'll take me too long. But that was then the basis for the Dachau trials. And the Dachau trials, like the Allied flyer cases, were conducted in a small room, smaller than this one. And there were 3 or 4 benches, one behind the other, just like this one. And the trial went as follows. Herr Schmidt, stand up. Stand up. Stand up. You are being accused of being an accomplice to crimes being committed, war crimes, in the killing and starvation and beating of inmates of the camp. What have you got to say for yourself? Guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Not guilty. Why not?
Same following orders.
Following orders, that's all you have to say. Sit down. Next, you. And go down the list. And after 20 or 30 such lists were through, all pretty similar. I wasn't there, I was just a cook. I never heard of it, you know, all excuses. All right, there's a lieutenant here and a lieutenant there, and there's a captain who is judge of the court, the judge, and defense counsel, you have anything to say? No, okay. Judges will now adjourn to consider their verdict, to go outside, come back 10 minutes later. All the defendants are found guilty and sentenced to death. Boom. You think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. Anyway, if you go to the Landsberg prison where they were executed, they will tell you that 1,000 people were killed that way. This was our earliest war crimes trials. When the war was over, I wanted to go home and never go back again. And I got out of the army, and then I ran into this friend of mine who's, when I told him what I was doing, he said, look, I'm a law clerk to Justice Jackson. They could sure use you. And shortly thereafter, I get a telegram from the Pentagon. Dear sir, they haven't called me sir in 3 years. Please come to the Pentagon. We would like to interview you for a job. So I went. There I was interviewed by Colonel Mickey Marcus. The name may mean something to you because he died as a general in Israel. Pardon me, but some of these stories are flashbacks and different from this old one. Make a long story short, I didn't want to go back. He said, we need you. I said, 3 years you didn't need me, now you need me? He said, yes, now we need you. I said, I'm not going into the army unless you declare war on Germany, now losing. He said, well, we'll give you a simulated rank of a full colonel. So I was going to go from sergeant to colonel. And I said, well, does that mean I can tell the other lieutenant colonels what to do? He said, yes. I'd been waiting for that 3 years. So I called up my girlfriend, who happens to be the mother of my son, and I said, how would you like to go to Europe for a brief honeymoon? And she said, I'd love it. I'm waiting about 10 years, but I went to law school and everything else. So we got married, and off I went. Now to Nuremberg, for the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. General Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, distinguished jurist, U.S. Supreme Court, the best of jurists. This trial was already on, and it had been agreed that after the first International Military Tribunal trial, where Goering was the defendant, you all know about that, there would be 12 additional trials in order to give the public a panorama of what German society was like. How was it possible for a civilized country like Germany to commit this type of enormous crimes? Absolutely indescribable. I haven't described the concentration camps, I assume you know. My job to get in and get out was full of diseases, bodies burning all over the place, and all that. So they were going to have 12 more trials. And the head of that was to be General Telford Taylor. He was not a military man. He was a Harvard graduate and later was a law professor with the law partners in New York. And of those 12 trials, the first one, for the medical students here, I promised to tell them something about it, was the medical case. The medical case was designed to show that the doctors of Germany, who were among the recognized best scientists in the world, were performing medical experiments on concentration camp inmates to determine how soon they could kill them if they put glass in their wounds or froze them to death, or high altitude experiments and all kinds of experiments. And the purpose of that trial was to demonstrate that even the medical profession was involved in committing the Nazi atrocities, and the judges laid down the standards. What is ethical behavior for a doctor in time of war with regard to prisoners? What can he do medically and what he cannot do without committing a crime? It was a great contribution because that subject had never been gone into in such depth before. And there was the justice case where the lawyers were taken to task for the same thing, perverting the law. That's the film Justice at Nuremberg. Someone asked me how authentic are the records of Nuremberg. The records are absolutely authentic. Everything was recorded. Everything was translated into German as well as in English, the international military trial as well as in French and Russian. Everything was open to the public. All of it was published. There were about 37 volumes of the international military trial, about 8 big red volumes of the documentation, and in the subsequent trials were also about 30 different volumes, 16 volumes, we had a big books of them. So the authentic records are there. The film records, Marlene Dietrich and all the other prominent actors there, they were Hollywoodized. It was a conglomeration. And I assured somebody, although I cannot be ever sure, that Marlene Dietrich never had an affair with one of the Nuremberg judges. So that was the trial. Now, what happened after that? And what was the significance of that? Justice Jackson put it very well, and Telford Taylor agreed, that the most important thing coming out of Nuremberg was the recognition and confirmation that aggression was a supreme international crime. Because when you are in an illegal war, you will commit all the other crimes. And that was the truth. My experience as a combat soldier, war is hell. Every crime conceivable is committed in time of war. To the women and so on, I guarantee you that there's never been a war without rape of victims, women, of the losing party. The Russians in Berlin had a field day and rape, and the war immediately ended. Jackson said, and Telford Taylor confirmed in the subsequent trials, that the law must apply equally to everyone. It was our intention there to take a step forward in the movement toward a more humane world. And the first thing you had to do was to stop the killing, stop the war making, and begin to develop an ethic of peace rather than an ethic of war. And that's really what Nuremberg was all about. Someone said, how do we judge in retrospect? Well, the United Nations was being formed at the same time. They had similar ideals. The use of armed force was prohibited, except in self-defense or on permission from the Security Council. There was to be disarmament. There was to be an international military force. And the Security Council was supposed to be the agency responsible for maintaining the peace. That was the dream. Well, no use spelling out, it didn't quite work out that way. And someone asked me, how do I evaluate what happened after that? During the Cold War, nothing happened after that. They had a lot of meetings at the UN. First, the question was, how do you define aggression? The first General Assembly of the United Nations, one day, had three resolutions. One, set up an international criminal court to follow up on Nuremberg. What was adjourned? Two, define aggression because people had been making a fuss about it. Although the Jackson had no problem with it, the French had no problem with it, the Russians had no problem with it, the British had no problem with it. There was a definition. It was clear whatever Hitler was doing, attacking Poland and Holland and Denmark and Sweden and France and so on, these were clear acts which were illegal under the discussions which took place after the First World War at the League of Nations. And all of those records were there and well known. So the plan of the United Nations was they'd set up another international criminal court and a draft code of crimes against the peace and security of mankind. Because it was pointed out in the judgment that crimes are not committed by organizations, by states, they're committed by individuals. The leaders who direct these crimes, who send the young people out to get killed, they are the criminals. And there's no sense in punishing a whole nation who are themselves victimized. That was what Nuremberg was about. And then along came the Cold War, and the committees talked, and they accomplished more talk, of which they are very good. The result was nothing. Then along came some changes. All right. They had a committee to define aggression. I sat through the meetings of that committee for 29 years. I remember when I was young. I'm only 91 now. And nobody paid me. I wasn't representing any organization. I was, of course, traumatized by my experiences, and I thought it was a terrible thing to send young people out to be killed. The young lady here, she's married to a new soldier. My goal now has been for many years is to stop that soldier from being killed. I lectured at West Point a few weeks ago, and I have lectured to the veterans on Veterans Day in the Library of Congress, to the Air Force Academy in Colorado. And my explanation to them is I don't want you to be killed. I don't want you to be wounded. And I don't know how to do that, short of trying to deter war making. If we can stop war making, what a great step forward it would be. Of course, there are skeptics who say it never happened before. We always had wars. God's will. The Germans, you know, Field Marshal said it's God's will. An idle dream, you know, war making. Well, I don't buy that. I don't buy it. People can be skeptical, but it's no excuse for inaction. If you're skeptical, but you know what your goal is and it's right, you'll work at it. You work at it. Pretty soon, you know, you got a little gadget in your hand, you can see an accident in China 2 minutes ago. You can send out 1,000 things. Someone told you that's possible. They said you're crazy. The Wright brothers, some of the people in the United States are quoting now a wobbly bicycle. This new cord is a wobbly bicycle. You must overload it. Well, if the Wright brothers who invented the airplane were worried about wobbly bicycles, we'd all be on bicycles here instead of by plane. And you got to step harder on the pedal and push harder and go further. Otherwise, you fall on your head. So I understand the concerns, but they are not justified, because it is right to try to prevent war. I know there are difficulties. People may be convinced in this room, other people are not convinced, and they will be throwing bombs at you. What do you do then? You're always entitled to self-defense under any theory, but you're not entitled to go beyond that. We have proportionality principles of humanitarian law, which come into play, but the main difficulty has been that we lack the institutions in order to maintain the peace. We didn't carry out the disarmament. We have nuclear weapons, which are totally obsolete today, costing billions of dollars. They're obsolete because I have it on the authority of an American general with whom I had breakfast in St. Petersburg a couple of months ago, and he was describing how from cyberspace today you can cripple the electrical net on planet Earth. The medical people will tell you, if you cut off all the water supplies and you cut off electricity and the computers don't work and the telephones don't work, how long does it take for everybody to die? They didn't know the answer. They didn't even know how long it takes if you drop somebody from the gallows before he's pronounced dead. I knew that. Those of you who are curious, 6 to 8 minutes. So we live in a gruesome world, a horrible world, because we have failed to build the institutions which are conceivable and which, in my considered judgment, are attainable. Not quickly, not easily. It'll take a long time. But we are certainly moving in that direction. We do have an international criminal court. Someone said, how does it work? It works like any newborn babe. It falls down, it messes up, it doesn't work properly. You have to nourish it. You don't stomp on it and say, oh, look, it doesn't do anything except eats, and it doesn't do anything. You have to encourage it. You have to nurse it along. I know the chief prosecutor. I've known all the people on the courts. They have always invited me somehow to come along and make a speech or do something to cheer them up. And it's a tough job. It's a very tough job. You get a complaint of atrocities, Darfur, for example, genocide, or the horror of all Rwanda. We had a genocide, we knew it was coming, and did nothing to prevent it. That's a big disgrace to the international community, to all civilized nations. Disgraceful, disgraceful. In our own time. So we have not done what we need to do to build the institutions with its difficulties. If you're going to go into a foreign country like Darfur, you don't have the language. There are many tribes that are killing each other, same color people, slight variation in tribal loyalties. You can't hire people to go in because they're afraid. They can't get in because they won't let them in. And you have to have proof according to standards of proof. There's our lawyers here. So it's difficult, and they have to proceed carefully, because if they don't proceed carefully, they're going to say, look, what kind of justice is that? They're going to get attacked no matter what. And they are being attacked, and it's a pity, because I know them as good people, trying very hard, and a job which may be impossible, but it's certainly very difficult. Now, let us move in on to where we are today. And what does it mean to you? More important. For me, I'm out of the picture already. We have the International Criminal Court, and the United States particularly has complained principle of legality. The question has not been defined. To tell me that aggression has not been defined makes me furious, because I spent 29 years listening to the defined expression, and then they took a consensus and everybody agreed. They took a nice picture, and the chairman of the committee, Bengt Brahms of Sweden, invited me to come and stand with the group, because I had spent more time editing volumes on defining aggression and lots of articles and giving them papers and all that. Stand with the group for the great event, the consensus definition of aggression. We had the International Law Commission, great experts from about 35 different countries. They considered, they talked about it, and they wrote reports, and they met, and they talked, and they agreed, and they split the hairs and everything else, and they said, oh, the Nuremberg definition, that was pretty good, we ought to follow that. And the French had agreed to that, the Russians had agreed to that, and the British had agreed to that, and 19 other nations had agreed to that, and the entire General Assembly of the United Nations had affirmed the Nuremberg Principles, and now they say it hasn't been defined. Well, it sounds like a good excuse, after all. If it hasn't been defined, how can you try somebody? It's obvious. But of course, if it's a lie, then it's not a good excuse, and I tell you, it's a plain lie. And if you don't believe me, I've given you the citations. And on top of that, you can look at my website, www.myname.benforens.org, and all of my books are available free of charge, and hundreds of articles free of charge, all courtesy of the United Nations Audiovisual Program. So you don't have to take notes, you don't have to buy my books, all you have to do is look it up for yourself, which I urge you to do. However, on top of that, they started defining aggression again. So they started, and what do you know, after 8 years since the Rome Statute, this was almost a breaking point in Rome. The truth was that the powerful nations were not prepared to give up what they called their sovereign right to decide when they're going to kill their neighbors. Put it politely, they want the right to decide for themselves what military action is necessary for the protection of their own national interests. This is what they want, okay? And this question has been on the agenda for almost 100 years. And they have never gone very far from that. Very few nations have been prepared to say, okay, we are ready not to do that. They agreed to the United Nations Charter, but then they ignored it. And there was no enforcement. And there still is no enforcement. The courts which have been set up, no enforcement. Now, if you want to have a lawful society, and I've thought about it and I've written about that too, you need three components. You need laws to define what's permissible and what's not permissible. You need courts to determine whether the laws have been violated, to serve as a medium for compromise, and you need a system of enforcement. Now, laws, courts, and enforcement are the three components on which every civilized society rests. Every city, every town, every country, every world. And to the extent that you have them, you have relative tranquility. To the extent that any of those legs is lacking, you don't have relative tranquility. The international arena, arena is a good name for it. The laws are just beginning. The courts are just beginning, but they are beginning. You have more international criminal courts functioning right now than I can probably list for you automatically. And the enforcement is missing. So you've got a system which is not yet operational. And what? How do you respond to that? You can say, pip, it's no good, get rid of it. Doesn't work. Wrong answer. You have to strengthen the, clarify the laws. We're doing that. You have to strengthen the courts. And you have to build an enforcement mechanism. When you do that, it shouldn't be too difficult, really. Then you will have to move forward. So, that is the current status. Now, what did we? What's going to happen now in Kampala? We are going to Kampala. I am going to Kampala. My son is going to Kampala. It's expensive going to Kampala. I know it's going to pay me for going to Kampala. But I will be richly rewarded if we come out. And they say that aggression is a punishable crime. In Rome, when this matter was debated, many nations did not want aggression included, purposes of their own protection of their own national sovereign rights. Many of the small nations said, without aggression, we don't go for the court. This is the main crime, and we have to deal with that. And so they reached a compromise. They said aggression will be listed as a crime. There are only four crimes listed. War crime, genocide, crimes against humanity, and aggression. And on the fourth one, on aggression, they said, however, the court cannot exercise its jurisdiction on the crime of aggression until certain conditions are met. Now, those who accepted that compromise tried to put in conditions which could never be met. That's where the game is played. You have to recognize the Security Council power. You have to redefine the definition. You have to deal with the elements of the crime, you see, the things thrown in the way as obstacles to prevent them from ever doing that. So they started to work on that, and they worked for about 8 years on that, and lo and behold, they are on the verge of reaching a new consensus definition of aggression. The biggest debate, you won't believe it, but it's true, the biggest debate was whether the provision that in order to be punishable, crime of aggression has to be of concern to the international community as a whole and has to be a violation of the UN Charter. The complaint was, what do you mean a violation of the UN Charter? It also said concern to the international community as a whole. I don't know what that means either. But they said it has to be a manifest violation of the UN Charter. The others said, no. It has to be a flagrant violation of the Charter. And I would guess, my son may also correct me if I'm wrong on the estimate, although he wasn't always there. At least 100 hours by at least 100 diplomats was debating, should it be a flagrant violation of the Charter or should it be a manifest violation of the Charter? And the beauty of it was the Chinese said, in our language, it doesn't make any difference. Okay. However, I am sure it's going to be a flagrant violation. If not, they'll settle that in Kampala. I hope the first day it'll be a flagrant violation, or whatever it is, give a damn about that. But that's the way it went. Now, on the question of Security Council control, here's the most interesting problem. As you know, the end of World War II, 50 million people about were killed. You never know how many people are killed in war. Nobody can tell me. I think people in graves. Anyway, they decided, with 50 million people dead, they would have to have an international court to deal with it, but the court has to be redefined and the Security Council has to retain its controls. That's the way it was set up at the beginning. All nations are created equal, but some are more equal than others, and those who have the power set up the agency, the United States, Soviet Union then, France, and the United Kingdom, they had a veto power. Now, it's obviously unfair. You say all are equal, some are more equal than others, have a veto power. But that was a result of a political compromise, which is not generally recognized. The United States, for example, in order for a treaty to be binding, and the United Nations Charter was a treaty, 2/3 of the Senate has to give its consent. The Senate of the United States is a very independent body. It's a great democracy. They have all points of view, as it should be. And so, they said, we're not going to consent to the United Nations unless we can control whether our boys are sent back or not. And that was accepted as a compromise, and that's the veto power, which is in the United Nations Charter, without which there would have been no United Nations. As the United States didn't join the League of Nations either, which led us from World War I to World War II. So there we have it. And they didn't want to give up their power. They don't want to give up their power today. So we're going to have a big debate in Kampala starting on Monday. I'll be speaking to a large group on Sunday night, so it starts early. And the United States will hold firm to its position. We need a definition. It hasn't been adequately defined. find my description of that argument. It's too bold for me to say it to such a respectable audience. A phony argument. And the role of the Security Council, already has the deck stacked. They're the only ones who can determine whether the crime of aggression by a state has occurred. That's in the Charter. They're given them the power to determine whether an act of aggression, which means not the crime of aggression, which is committed by an individual, but an act of aggression by a state has occurred. And those who favor the court say the court has to be independent. How can they be independent if they're dependent upon another body? Well, it's not quite that way. They're not dependent upon another body except to prove that the crime occurred. And this is the rub. The prosecutor has no prohibition from the Security Council to release the criminal at any time. The judges have the right to sentence. There are 18 judges chosen from all legal systems in the world to supervise the activities of this court. The ladies in the audience here will be happy to know that I was following the elections from my winter hideaway in Florida with saving my wife on the computer. My son was in the United Nations when they were electing. The first 7 judges elected were female. I thought, boy, they're not even going to let a man on the bench, which perhaps would have been a big improvement. But in any case, you've got a fair bunch of people. You've got 111 nations have signed on to the court. The notion that this prosecutor would suddenly go wild and begin, for political reasons, arresting people, this ridiculous notion is not going to happen. He's a distinguished human rights activist with excellent reputation, Marino Ocampo, Luis Marino Ocampo, and he's supervised by a panel of judges for every little step that he has to make, and you have the 18 judges there as well. So these are phony arguments. They are not persuasive arguments. And nobody wants to get up and say, look, I'm in favor of war. That's too stupid. So they say, it's not that I'm against war, but you've got to have it defined, even though it's been defined. You have to have new powers in the Security Council, although they already have the power. It's there in many other provisions of the statute, too complicated to go into. So anyway, I'm convinced that the objections from all sides are overblown. When you compare it to the current situation, anybody who wants to commit the crime of aggression, any leader of any state, we're only talking about the leaders. We're not talking about the soldiers. We're talking about the leaders who plan to perpetrate the massive crimes. That's what we're talking about. He is immune from prosecution under the ICC statute. It says specifically they may not exercise their jurisdiction because the other conditions have not been met. Now, there are criminologists here. I noticed there's a school of criminology here. I was a criminologist among my many careers. Incidentally, that case that you saw, that was the biggest murder trial in history. I convicted all 22 defendants of murdering over 1 million Jews in cold blood, hundreds of thousands of children murdered one shot at a time by shooting at the infant clutched to his mother's breast so he could save ammunition. And 13 of them were sentenced to death, 4 of them were actually executed. 27, as been pointed out, that was my first case. That's such a good record, I never had another case. However, now we come back to the reality of today. The statute means that anyone who commits a crime of aggression, any leader, is immune from prosecution. If that does not change, will it deter crime? As criminologists, I ask you, if we put up a notice, murder is a crime, but no one can be prosecuted for it because no court has jurisdiction to deal with it, does that deter the crime or does it increase the crime? On the one hand, they talk about stopping the immunity. They call it impunity because it sounds more confusing. But stopping the immunity of massive murder is a supreme international crime. And yet, by not making it punishable, they encourage the crime. The exact opposite of what they're trying to do. And I'm trying to explain it to them. And I'm having a terribly difficult time. The Americans particularly feel that no, the court is going to be overburdened. They can't really deal with the other crimes. It's well because they'll be so busy with aggression and they'll be, poor prosecutor will not be able to handle it, so forget about it, take it up some other time, postpone it, like the Charter Review for the United Nations. 60 years ago they said we're going to have a review conference, we're still waiting. All kinds of excuses to get out of it. How it will end up, I don't know. There are various compromises on the table. We'll both be there. We'll have no official position whatsoever. Some of them listen, some of them don't. What will happen, I don't know. It's not my fate, it's your fate, and the fate of your children. What you can do about it, you can think about it, you can see whether you agree with me. War making is a horrible thing, it should be condemned as a crime. It should be punishable as a crime in the hope that it will deter future wars. Even to a small extent, it certainly is worthwhile. It'll save you all the money that you could use for health and so on. President Eisenhower said, every penny spent on armaments is theft from the poor. He also said that in a real sense, the world can no longer rely on force. It must rely on the rule of law. And so I go around preaching for the rule of law. If you agree with what I've said, join me, talk to the people, whoever you can, and I hope we'll all be successful. Thank you very much. Take all the difficult questions. Who's going to begin the parade? There's a young man.
I would like, I wish I were.
You are. I'm 91. How old are you? Young?
A bit younger.
Okay.
I would like to take you back to 1945.
Yes, do that. I'd like to be back in 1945. Go ahead.
You said that you come from the European family.
Yes, I came from Transylvania. My sister was born in the same house. She was born in Hungary. I was born in Romania. They're not hanging me, they're just pulling up the curtain.
So I guess you had some members of your family perished in the war.
Yes, my grandmother was murdered in Auschwitz. I did not know that at the time of the Nuremberg trials. That was not a consideration, as I pointed out in the opening statement.
No, this is not what I mean. What I would like to ask you is to talk a little bit about your personal feeling as the prosecutor of the members of the Eisenhower group.
Okay, I will tell you that, because that's a very important question. The people who were murdered by the Einsatzgruppe, these were special extermination squads, 3,000 men divided into four units. Their assignment was to go out, kill every Jewish man, woman, and child you lay your hands on, every gypsy, the same thing, any communist officials, or anybody else you think might be a threat to the Reich, now or in the future. I talked to the mass murderers. Best example is Otto Ohlendorf, my lead defendant, who killed, according to his report, 90,000 Jews. When asked why he did that, he was a very educated man, Dr. Ohlendorf. Most of my defendants had doctorate degrees. They were selected on the basis of their rank and their education. One of them, Dr. Rush, he did the Babi Yar job, 33,771 Jews killed in 2 days. Okay. How did they explain? Nice, intelligent people. 5 children, loved cats and dogs, I'm sure. He's kind to the birds in the nest. He said, well, it was in self-defense. I said, why is self-defense? We attack all these neighboring countries. Where is self-defense? But we knew that Soviet Union intended to attack us, and therefore we had to beat them to the punch. Why did you kill all the Jews? Everybody knows the Jews were in favor of the Bolsheviks. Why did you kill the little children? Well, if they grew up and they knew that we had eliminated their parents, they never used the word kill. They would be enemies of Germany, so we're interested in a permanent peace for our country, and therefore we had to kill them. Well, did it bother you? Did you ever feel it was something? Well, I didn't have all the facts. In fact, Hitler had all the facts. He knew more than I did. We trusted him. He was our leader. So what do you want from me? Self-defense? No mens rea, no evil intent. And so he went to his death believing that what he did was right. And the same applied to the other defendants. My biggest disappointment in Germany was no remorse on the part of the mass murderers, none. Albert Speer, I talked to him after he spent 20 years in Spandau prison. And I had written a book, Lesson Slave, which was published by Harvard University. And there I told the story of German abuse of slave labor. And all the German industries, which I had approached, this goes back now about 40 years ago, I felt that they owed something to their surviving victims. They said, no, 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 we were forced to do this, the conditions were fine, everybody suffered, we don't owe them anything. And I wanted to get from Speer. I put a question to him. He agreed to meet me secretly. After 20 years in Spandau prison, I'd been in Spandau prison. It was not a nice prison, particularly when the Russians handled it. They divided the control over the four powers. I said, Herr Speer, I have your reports on who requested labor, under what conditions labor will be provided, what conditions they had to be worked under, minimum sustenance, maximum production, when they're no longer capable of producing, ship them off back to where they came, concentration camp to be exterminated and burned. They all say it's not true, that they were such good condition. How do you explain that? He said, they're lying. I know they're lying. But can I quote you to that effect? He said, yes. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will send you the manuscript. And if there's anything wrong in my manuscript, I want you to correct it. I want to spell nothing but the truth. I sent him the manuscript. He wrote back on every page, Einverstanden, Einverstanden, agreed. I took that as a sign of remorse. He also, when he was in prison, wrote some best-selling books in which he said, I feel myself partly responsible for Auschwitz because I knew what was happening and I didn't speak up. And so when I say there was no remorse, there was no remorse that I encountered among the Einsatzgruppen defendants. Speer was a bit of an exception. I think that saved his life because his deputy was hanged and he was given 20 years in prison. So how else to explain it? I am going to receive, today is what, Thursday? Next week? No, tomorrow. When is it done? When am I going to get a German government going to give me a Dienstkreuz? I had some hesitation, frankly, in accepting that. But it's a new Germany, and they're going out of their way to try to make amends. Another point here, I have a little time. I then set up the whole restitution program, Shulamim, Video Line, for the Nazi victims. I was the Director General of the Jewish Restitution Successor Organization, which recovered the Ehlers property from murdered Jews and used the money for the rehabilitation of survivors. The German government, the West German government, inspired by Konrad Adenauer, a devout Catholic, agreed to make compensation payable to some of the survivors, limited amounts. Germany itself was bankrupt at the time. How do you get a bankrupt country destroyed as we did Germany? Get them to pay some of the victims when they themselves are starving. That was a trick. We did it. This is not the subject of this thing. I may be talking to somebody on Sunday night at a group, Victims' Rights. We'll talk about that. But it's a very complicated thing, and my conclusion was from all of these efforts, how difficult it was, how inadequate it was, that really, we have to get away from the idea of settling others' views by killing innocent people. And that's what war is. We send soldiers out, don't know the people who they're killing and they're being killed in return. For what? Because they refuse to settle by going to a court. No matter what the court decision may be, if it's a wrong decision, sometimes there are wrong decisions. Sometimes the judges are corrupt or stupid, pardon me, some of them are. But so what? It's much better than what you see in wartime. And I know that because I've seen it. I've seen the results. And it, who's left alive to tell the story? I'm the only Nuremberg prosecutor left alive. They're all dead. So I pass it on to you. Let's get another question here. Yes, young lady. You have to speak louder because this here is 91 years old.
Would you speak more about the procedures in place for Nuremberg trials?
Okay. That's very easy. I wrote an article, Nuremberg Trial Procedure and the Rights of the Accused. You'll find it on my website. But and free. and it was written then in 1947 or something like that. Procedure was absolutely fair. The judges came from different nationalities, true, victors, judges, who else should judge them? It was hard to find any neutrals, real neutrals. Every defendant was required to receive from the prosecution, 30 days in advance at least, every single document intent to offer in evidence, in translations, in the language that he understood. He was allowed to have defense counsel of his own choice, plus an assistant. In my trial, for example, I had 22 defendants. I had myself as a chief prosecutor and three assistants who were people who were left over from other trials, some should have been fired. On the other side, I had 22 defendants, each one with two defense counsel. I had 44 defense counsel, experienced former Nazi lawyers on one side, and a young kid from New York who knew very little about Germany, and a couple of assistants there to present the prosecution. If there was any unfairness, talk about, you know, balancing of powers and so on, it was the unfairness the other side. They knew what had happened. They knew what the documents were. All I knew is that I had one set of the documents. And that's all I needed. We discovered that in the files in Berlin. They had sent out 100 reports. The Ereignismeldungen aus der UdSSR, the reports from the Eastern Front. And I tabulated that, and I knew who the commanders were and how many they killed in which town. And all their lies and invasions and so on. I rested my case in 2 days and convicted them all. Okay, another question. The young lady here. Take the young lady.
One of the arguments made against prosecuting aggression is that it lowers the incentive for soldiers to refrain from committing other crimes like genocide, crimes against humanity, because if they're in an aggressive war already, then
well,
I wonder what you think of
that. That is an argument which is made, that if he has to concentrate on aggression, they won't have enough time to deal with genocide, crimes against humanity, so on. The poor prosecutors are going to be overworked. I call that a baloney argument, Because the prosecutor, if he's not able to handle his case, will call for assistance and we'll provide it for him. It's never been a long time before you try anybody for the crime of aggression. You may have a small state, and if the prosecutor can't cope with it, he can't cope with the other crimes now because of the other inherent difficulties in it. It's not because he can't apportion the work or that he refuses to try them. And you have also the question we have not mentioned of complementarity. Every state can try their own criminals. They get priority. For example of war crimes. Today, the United States government has a military code of crimes. They can transfer all the cases involving war crimes to the United States courts, and they will be given priority. If they wanted to undercut the... I'm getting a signal, that's enough.
No, that's not the signal. A different signal when it's enough. That signal that's enough is like this.
I see.
The reason I have my hand up is this.
You want to ask
the
question? Let me ask you.
I think the question was differently nuanced. I think the question that was being posed, which I'd like to comment on myself.
Do that while I have a drink in with my
sure is a good year. The one you've got the hearing aid in for me. The question was, with respect to the crime of aggression, whether if you have aggression in the statute, and a soldier knows that they may already be accountable for committing the crime of aggression, whether the fact that they're covered under aggression may make them more liable to go out and commit war crimes rather than less likely to commit war crimes.
Well, then you can answer the question.
Respond to that, and you can also...
Yeah, you answer the question while I have a drink of water, okay?
In particular, with respect to the crime of aggression, one of the criticisms of the way in which the crime of aggression is being framed before the ICC review conference is that it is only a leadership crime. And therefore, it in fact wouldn't apply to a soldier in the field in the same way that other types of atrocity crimes might. And it's been criticized for that. People like Bill Shavis at the Irish Center for Human Rights have said that he doesn't agree with that position. He doesn't think it should be a leadership crime. And yet, the fact that it is a leadership crime, I think, goes in part to some of the tension that you're talking about. For example, a commander on the ground who may not be in a planning position with respect to the crime of aggression, and therefore, even if the court does have the crime of aggression, he may not ever be able to be in a position to be culpable of that crime, could still himself be perhaps culpable of the crime
for my son? And you should know by now, know the answers. Somebody else? That lady there?
What are your views on the death penalty for war criminals and
Well, let me give you my views, and that may not be true view here, I don't know. But I did not ask for the death penalty. I had the worst mass murderers you can possibly imagine. And I asked myself, what do I ask for? It's considered normal for the prosecutors to recommend the penalty to the judges. If the judges had decided to take these defendants who had murdered over a million people, innocent people in cold blood, and chop them up into a million pieces, feed them to the dogs, I would not have objected. But I thought, there is no penalty that I can imagine which would balance the scales of justice of 22 people as against the enormous number of innocent children and women that they had murdered. And so I asked the court to affirm by penal action the right of all human beings to live in peace and dignity. That was right in the opening statement. Because these people were murdered because they didn't share the race, religion, the ideology of their executions. And I thought that it was a terrible thing then. I have never stopped thinking that's a terrible thing. And if I have to choose between consideration for the human rights of a murderer and the feelings of his victims, my sympathies go first with the victims. And if they would take offense and are being lenient in the sentencing, I think that would be a false approach. I think there should have been no leniency in those sentences. In fact, although 13 were sentenced to death, only 4 were executed, and the rest of them were out of prison within 4 or 5 years after that, and most of the others never were tried. There were 3,000 men who every day went out and murdered thousands of people, mostly Jews, and we only tried 22. There's no justice in that. We selected those we had at the highest rank. The rest were never tried. Where is justice? Justice is always comparative. We only had a sampling. What else could we do? We'd still be in Germany trying cases if we had that. So it was an effort to disclose the truth, to alert people to the immorality of the argumentation made, which has been made by other governments since then, saying it's necessary for our self-defense to attack, even before the Security Council has approved. England is familiar with the problem, it's the arm of Washington. So we are struggling to reach out for a more humane, rational order under the rule of law. And it's imperfect. And all we can do is hope that young people, like most of you, will see that and agree with that. And we'll take whatever steps you can to move toward a more rational human world.
So. Do you think it's possible to draw a line between a preemptive war and a war of aggression? Or is that distinction desirable?
There should be no such thing as preemptive war. Now, it is permissible, if someone's pointing a gun at you, do you shoot him first? I've been in that situation. That is permissible self-defense if you have a preemptive war, but a preventive war in anticipation that he might attack us, which is what the Ohlendorf argument was denounced by the court. Here is great consideration of a long decision on the whole issue of preventive war, preemptive war. A preemptive war in anticipation is not permissible. Of course, the whole idea of allowing the use of force under any circumstances is the world in which we live. If somebody's throwing bombs at you, what are you going to do? You can't say, well, Florence is going to build up an international criminal court in the year 2000, 3000. You have to defend yourself as best you can until such time. If the house is burning, you call the fire department. The next time you try to build a house of brick, you're not of straw. And so you have to be builders of the institutions which we need in order to have a more rational world. I think that about wraps up our questions. Oh, one more from the young fellow there.
Do you think it's appropriate to try alleged war criminals from the Nazi era today? Is
very good question, and it's related to an earlier question we had. First, if there is a statute of limitations, then it's not appropriate. But there is no statute of limitations for being a direct murderer. There are statutes for the accomplice. What is happening, and I'm very familiar with it, is that people enter the United States, for example, or England, on the false pretenses, in that they denied that they were a member of any Nazi party, and so on. And it turned out they were camp guards somewhere, and for the last 40 years they've been living in Kansas and raised a family, and they've been living happily ever after, and they never committed any more crimes, and they never will. And the question is it humane to take a person like that and then say, ha-ha, now we caught you? It sounds terrible, but it's not terrible, because you have to think of the victims, too. And that's always made the balance. And if I have to choose between the victim saying, ha, they finally caught the guy who killed my mother, my father, and my children, and they're going to let him go, my sympathies go with the victims always before they go with the criminal. Now, they're not going to chop him up into 100 pieces. They're going to revoke his citizenship and deport him, if they can, to the country from which he came. That will be the punishment for him. It's unfair in the sense that he's usually a small fry. The big fry are loose, or now by now they're dead. So it's a passing problem. But in answering your question, I've gotten that question before, I have very mixed feelings. But on balance, I think the one who was the criminal and committed the crimes and who evaded punishment is the one who should pay the price rather than the victims having to see that he escaped. And on that happy note, I thank you all.
Not much else to say, really. But once again, just a real honour, I think, to have Ben Ferenc with us and catching him on this kind of whistle stop tour through Europe and just before he goes to Kampala. Thanks very much to all of you for coming out as well. We've still got 4 meetings left in this series this term, so please check the OTJR website for those meetings. Also, for anyone who'd like to stick around for a glass of wine and some nibbles, they'll be available in the Centre for Sociolegal